maybe thousands by this time, seeing as they feed off fear and despair.
All right, all right, blustered Vernon Dursley. You've made your point.
I hope so, said Harry, because once I'm 17, all of them, Death Eaters, Dementors, maybe even Inferi, which means dead bodies enchanted by a dark wizard, we'll be able to find you and we'll certainly attack you. And if you remember the last time you tried to outrun wizards, I think you'll agree you need help. There was a brief silence in which the distant echo of Hagrid smashing down a wooden front door seemed to reverberate through the intervening years. Aunt Petunia was looking at Uncle Vernon. Dudley was staring at Harry. Finally, Uncle Vernon blurted out,
But what about my work? What about Dudley's school? I don't suppose those things matter to a bunch of layabout wizards.
Don't you understand? Shouted Harry. They will torture and kill you like they did my parents.
Dad, said Dudley in a loud voice. Dad, I'm going with these Order people.
Dudley, said Harry, for the first time in your life, you're talking sense. He knew that the battle was won. If Dudley was frightened enough to accept the Order's help, his parents would accompany him. There could be no question of being separated from their diddikins. Harry glanced at the carriage clock on the mantelpiece. They'll be here in about 5 minutes, he said, and when none of the Dursleys replied, he left the room. The prospect of parting, probably forever, from his aunt, uncle, and cousin, was one that he was able to contemplate quite cheerfully. But there was nevertheless a certain awkwardness in the air. What did you say to one another at the end of 16 years' solid dislike? Back in his bedroom, Harry fiddled aimlessly with his rucksack, then poked a couple of owl nuts through the bars of Hedwig's cage. They fell with dull thuds to the bottom, where she ignored them.
We're leaving soon, really soon, Harry told her, and then you'll be able to fly again.
The doorbell rang. Harry hesitated, then headed back out of his room and downstairs. It was too much to expect Hestia and Daedalus to cope with the Dursleys on their own.
Harry Potter, squeaked an excited voice the moment Harry had opened the door. A small man in a mauve top hat was sweeping him a deep bow. An honour, as ever.
Thanks, Daedalus, said Harry, bestowing a small and embarrassed smile upon the dark-haired Hestia. It's really good of you to do this. They're through here, my aunt and uncle and cousin.
Good day to you, Harry Potter's relatives, said Daedalus happily, striding into the living room.
The Dursleys did not look at all happy to be addressed thus. Harry half expected another change of mind. Dudley shrank nearer to his mother at the sight of the witch and wizard.
I see you are packed and ready. Excellent. The plan, as Harry has told you, is a simple one, said Daedalus, pulling an immense pocket watch out of his waistcoat and examining it. We shall be leaving before Harry does, due to the danger of using magic in your house. Harry, being still underage, it could provide the Ministry with an excuse to arrest him. We shall be driving, say, 10 miles or so, before disapparating to the safe location we have picked out for you. You know how to drive, I take it? He asked Uncle Vernon politely.
Know how to... Of course I ruddy know how to drive, spluttered Uncle Vernon.
Very clever of you, sir. Very clever. I personally would be utterly bamboozled by all those buttons and knobs, said Daedalus.
He was clearly under the impression that he was flattering Vernon Dursley, who was visibly losing confidence in the plan with every word Daedalus spoke.
"Can't even drive,"
he muttered under his breath, his moustache rippling indignantly. But fortunately, neither Daedalus nor Hestia seemed to hear him.
"You, Harry," Daedalus continued, "will wait here for your guard. There's been a little change in the arrangements."
"What do you mean?" said Harry at once. "I thought Mad-Eye was going to come and take me by side-along apparition."
"Can't do it," said Hestia tersely. Mad-Eye will explain."
The Dursleys, who had listened to all of this with looks of utter incomprehension on their faces, jumped as a loud voice screeched,
"Hurry up!"
Harry looked all around the room before realizing that the voice had issued from Daedalus's pocket watch.
"Quite right. We're operating to a very tight schedule," said Daedalus, nodding at his watch and tucking it back into his waistcoat. "We are attempting to time your departure from the house with your family's disapparition, Harry. Thus, the charm breaks at the moment you all head for safety."
He turned to the Dursleys.
"Well, are we all packed and ready to go?"
None of them answered him. Uncle Vernon was still staring, appalled, at the bulge in Daedalus's waistcoat pocket.
"Perhaps we should wait outside in the hall, Daedalus," murmured Hestia.
She clearly felt that it would be tactless for them to remain in the room while Harry and the Dursleys exchanged loving, possibly tearful farewells. "There's no need," Harry muttered, but Uncle Vernon made any further explanation unnecessary by saying loudly,
"Well, this is goodbye then, boy."
He swung his right arm upward to shake Harry's hand, but at the last moment seemed unable to face it and merely closed his fist and began swinging it backward and forward like a metronome.
"Ready, Diddy?"
asked Aunt Petunia, fussily checking the clasp of her handbag so as to avoid looking at Harry altogether. Dudley did not answer, but stood there with his mouth slightly ajar, reminding Harry a little of the giant, Grawp.
"Come along, then," said Uncle Vernon.
He had already reached the living room door when Dudley mumbled,
"I don't understand." "What don't you understand, Popkin?"
asked Aunt Petunia, looking up at her son. Dudley raised a large, ham-like hand to point at Harry.
"Why isn't he coming with us?"
Uncle Vernon and Aunt Petunia froze where they stood, staring at Dudley as though he had just expressed a desire to become a ballerina.
"What?"
said Uncle Vernon loudly.
"Why isn't he coming too?"
asked Dudley.
"Well, he doesn't want to,"
said Uncle Vernon, turning to glare at Harry and adding,
"You don't want to, do you?"
"Not in the slightest," said Harry.
"There you are,"
Uncle Vernon told Dudley.
"Now, come on, we're off."
He marched out of the room. They heard the front door open, but Dudley did not move, and after a few faltering steps, Aunt Petunia stopped too.
"What now?"
barked Uncle Vernon, reappearing in the doorway. It seemed that Dudley was struggling with concepts too difficult to put into words. After several moments of apparently painful internal struggle, he said,
"But where's he going to go?"
Aunt Petunia and Uncle Vernon looked at each other. It was clear that Dudley was frightening them. Hestia Jones broke the silence.
"But surely you know where your nephew is going?"
she asked, looking bewildered.
"Certainly we know," said Vernon Dursley. "He's off with some of your lot, isn't he? Right, Dudley, let's get in the car. You heard the man. We're in a hurry."
Again, Vernon Dursley marched as far as the front door, but Dudley did not follow.
"Off with some of our lot?"
Hestia looked outraged. Harry had met this attitude before. Witches and wizards seemed stunned that his closest living relatives took so little interest in the famous Harry Potter.
"It's fine," Harry assured her. "It doesn't matter, honestly."
"Doesn't matter?"
repeated Hestia, her voice rising ominously.
"Don't these people realize what you've been through? What danger you are in? The unique position you hold in the hearts of the anti-Voldemort movement?"
No, they don't, said Harry. "They think I'm a waste of space, actually, but I'm used to..."
"I don't think you're a waste of space."
If Harry had not seen Dudley's lips move, he might not have believed it. As it was, he stared at Dudley for several seconds before accepting that it must have been his cousin who had spoken. For one thing, Dudley had turned red. Harry was embarrassed and astonished himself.
"Well, thanks, Dudley."
Again, Dudley appeared to grapple with thoughts too unwieldy for expression before mumbling,
"You saved my life."
"Not really," said Harry. "It was your soul the Dementor would have taken." He looked curiously at his cousin. They had had virtually no contact during this summer or last, as Harry had come back to Privet Drive so briefly and kept to his room so much. It now dawned on Harry, however, that the cup of cold tea on which he had trodden that morning might not have been a booby trap at all. Although rather touched, he was nevertheless quite relieved that Dudley appeared to have exhausted his ability to express his feelings. After opening his mouth once or twice more, Dudley subsided into scarlet-faced silence. Aunt Petunia burst into tears. Hestia Jones gave her an approving look that changed to outrage as Aunt Petunia ran forward and embraced Dudley rather than Harry.
"'It's so sweet, Dudders!'
she sobbed into his massive chest.
"'Such a lovely boy, saying thank you!'
"'But he hasn't said thank you at all,' said Hestia indignantly. "'He only said he didn't think Harry was a waste of space.'
"'Yeah, but coming from Dudley, that's like, I love you,' said Harry, torn between annoyance and a desire to laugh, as Aunt Petunia continued to clutch at Dudley as if he had just saved Harry from a burning building.
"'Are we going or not?'
roared Uncle Vernon, reappearing yet again at the living-room door.
"'I thought we were on a tight schedule.'
"'Yes, yes, we are.'
said Daedalus Diggle, who had been watching these exchanges with an air of bemusement, and now seemed to pull himself together.
"'We really must be off, Harry!'
He tripped forward and wrung Harry's hand with both of his own.
"'Good luck. I hope we meet again. The hopes of the wizarding world rest upon your shoulders.'
"'Oh,' said Harry. "'Right. Thanks.'
"'Farewell, Harry!'
said Hestia, also clasping his hand.
"'Our thoughts go with you.'
"'I hope everything's okay,' said Harry, with a glance toward Aunt Petunia and Dudley.
"'Oh, I'm sure we shall end up the best of chums,' said Diggle brightly, waving his hat as he left the room.
Hestia followed him. Dudley gently released himself from his mother's clutches and walked toward Harry, who had to repress an urge to threaten him with magic. Then Dudley held out his large pink hand.
"'Blimey, Dudley,' said Harry over Aunt Petunia's renewed sobs.
"'Did the Dementors blow a different personality into you?'
"'Dunno,'
muttered Dudley.
"'See ya, Harry?'
"'Yeah,' said Harry, taking Dudley's hand and shaking it. "'Maybe. Take care, Big D.' Dudley nearly smiled, then lumbered from the room. Harry heard his heavy footfalls on the gravelled drive, and then a car door slammed. Aunt Petunia, whose face had been buried in her handkerchief, looked around at the sound. She did not seem to have expected to find herself alone with Harry. Hastily stowing her wet handkerchief into her pocket, she said, "Well, goodbye," and marched toward the door without looking at him.
"Goodbye," said Harry.
She stopped and looked back. For a moment, Harry had the strangest feeling that she wanted to say something to him. She gave him an odd, tremulous look, and seemed to teeter on the edge of speech, but then, with a little jerk of her head, she bustled out of the room after her husband and son. Chapter 4 The Seven Potters. Harry ran back upstairs to his bedroom, arriving at the window just in time to see the Dursleys' car swinging out of the drive and off up the road. Daedalus's top hat was visible between Aunt Petunia and Dudley in the back seat. The car turned right at the end of Privet Drive. Its windows burned scarlet for a moment in the now setting sun, and then it was gone. Harry picked up Hedwig's cage, his firebolt and his rucksack, gave his unnaturally tidy bedroom one last sweeping look, and then made his ungainly way back downstairs to the hall, where he deposited cage, broomstick, and bag near the foot of the stairs. The light was fading rapidly now, the hall full of shadows in the evening light. It felt most strange to stand here in the silence and know that he was about to leave the house for the last time. Long ago, when he had been left alone while the Dursleys went out to enjoy themselves, the hours of solitude had been a rare treat. Pausing only to sneak something tasty from the fridge,
He had rushed upstairs to play on Dudley's computer or put on the television and flicked through the channels to his heart's content. It gave him an odd, empty feeling to remember those times. It was like remembering a younger brother whom he had lost. "Don't you want to take a last look at the place?" he asked Hedwig, who was still sulking with her head under her wing. "We'll never be here again. Don't you want to remember all the good times? I mean, look at this doormat. What memories. Dudley puked on it after I saved him from the Dementors. Turns out he was grateful after all. Can you believe it? And last summer, Dumbledore walked through that front door." Harry lost the thread of his thoughts for a moment, and Hedwig did nothing to help him retrieve it, but continued to sit with her head under her wing. Harry turned his back on the front door. "And under here, Hedwig," Harry pulled open a door under the stairs, "is where I used to sleep. You never knew me then. Blimey, it's small. I'd forgotten." Harry looked around at the stacked shoes and umbrellas, remembering how he used to wake every morning, looking up at the underside of the staircase, which was more often than not adorned with a spider or two. Those had been the days before he had known anything about his true identity, before he had found out how his parents had died, or why such strange things often happened around him. But Harry could still remember the dreams that had dogged him, even in those days. Confused dreams, involving flashes of green light, and once, Uncle Vernon had nearly crashed the car when Harry had recounted it, a flying motorbike. There was a sudden deafening roar from somewhere nearby. Harry straightened up with a jerk and smacked the top of his head on the low doorframe. Pausing only to employ a few of Uncle Vernon's choicest swear words, he staggered back into the kitchen, clutching his head and staring out of the window into the back garden. The darkness seemed to be rippling, the air itself quivering. Then, one by one, figures began to pop into sight as their disillusionment charms lifted. Dominating the scene was Hagrid, wearing a helmet and goggles and sitting astride an enormous motorbike with a black sidecar attached. All around him, other people were dismounting from brooms and, in two cases, skeletal black-winged horses. Wrenching open the back door, Harry hurtled into their midst. There was a general cry of greeting as Hermione flung her arms around him. Ron clapped him on the back, and Hagrid said,
"All right, Harry, ready for the off?"
"Definitely," said Harry, beaming around at them all. "But I wasn't expecting this many of you." "Change of plan," growled Mad-Eye, who was holding two enormous bulging sacks, and whose magical eye was spinning from darkening sky to house to garden with dizzying rapidity. "Let's get under cover before we talk you through it." Harry led them all back into the kitchen, where, laughing and chattering, they settled on chairs, sat themselves upon Aunt Petunia's gleaming work surfaces, or leaned up against her spotless appliances. Ron, long and lanky, Hermione, her bushy hair tied back in a long plait, Fred and George, grinning identically, Bill, badly scarred and long-haired, Mr. Weasley, kind-faced, balding, his spectacles a little awry, Mad-Eye, battle-worn, one-legged, his bright blue magical eye whizzing in its socket, Tonks, whose short hair was her favourite shade of bright pink, Lupin, greyer, more lined, Fleur, slender and beautiful, with her long silvery blonde hair, Kingsley, bald, black, broad-shouldered, Hagrid, with his wild hair and beard, standing hunchbacked to avoid hitting his head on the ceiling, and Mundungus Fletcher, small, dirty and hangdog, with his droopy basset hound's eyes and matted hair. Harry's heart seemed to expand and glow at the sight. He felt incredibly fond of all of them, even Mundungus, whom he had tried to strangle the last time they had met. "Kingsley, I thought you were looking after the Muggle Prime Minister," he called across the room.
"He can get along without me for one night," said Kingsley. "You're more important."
"Harry, guess what?"
said Tonks from her perch on top of the washing machine, and she wiggled her left hand at him. A ring glittered there.
"You got married," Harry yelped, looking from her to Lupin.
I'm sorry you couldn't be there, Harry. It was very quiet.
That's brilliant.
All right, we'll have time for a cozy catch-up later,
roared Moody over the hubbub, and silence fell in the kitchen. Moody dropped his sacks at his feet and turned to Harry.
As Daedalus probably told you, we had to abandon Plan A. Pyre's thickness has gone over, which gives us a big problem. He's made it an imprisonable offence to connect this house to the flu network. Place a port key here, or apparate in or out. All done in the name of your protection, to prevent you-know-who getting in at you. Absolutely pointless, seeing as your mother's charm does that already. What he's really done is to stop you getting out of here safely.
Second problem. You're underage, which means you've still got the trace on you.
The trace,
said Mad-Eye impatiently.
The charm that detects magical activity around under-17s, the way the Ministry finds out about underage magic. If you or anyone around you casts a spell to get you out of here, Thickness is going to know about it, and so will the Death Eaters. We can't wait for the trace to break, because the moment you turn 17, you'll lose all the protection your mother gave you. In short, Pious Thickness thinks he's got you cornered good and proper.
Harry could not help but agree with the unknown Thickness. So, what are we going to do?
We're going to use the only means of transport left to us. The only ones the trace can't detect, because we don't need to cast spells to use them. Brooms, thestrals, and Hagrid's motorbike.
Harry could see flaws in this plan, however, he held his tongue to give Mad-Eye the chance to address them.
Now, your mother's charm will only break under two conditions. When you come of age, or...
Moody gestured around the pristine kitchen.
You no longer call this place home. You and your aunt and uncle are going your separate ways tonight, in the full understanding that you're never going to live together again, correct?
Harry nodded.
So, this time, when you leave, there'll be no going back, and the charm will break the moment you get outside its range. We're choosing to break it early, because the alternative is waiting for you-know-who to come and seize you the moment you turn 17. The one thing we've got on our side is that you-know-who doesn't know we're moving you tonight. We've leaked a fake trail to the Ministry. They think you're not leaving until the 30th. However, this is you-know-who we're dealing with, so we can't just rely on him getting the date wrong. He's bound to have a couple of Death Eaters patrolling the skies in this general area, just in case. So, we've given a dozen different houses every protection we can throw at them. They all look like they could be the place we're going to hide you. They've all got some connection with the Order. My house, Kingsley's place, Molly's Auntie Muriel's, you get the idea.
Yeah, said Harry, not entirely truthfully because he could still spot a gaping hole in the plan.
You'll be going to Tonks, parents. Once you're within the boundaries of the protective enchantments we've put on their house, you'll be able to use a port key to the burrow. Any questions?
Yes, said Harry.
Maybe they won't know which of the 12 secure houses I'm heading for at first, but won't it be sort of obvious once...
He performed a quick head count.
14 of us fly off toward Tonks' parents?
Ah, said Moody.
I forgot to mention the key point. 14 of us won't be flying to Tonks' parents. There will be 7 Harry Potters moving through the skies tonight, each of them with a companion, each pair heading for a different safe house.
From inside his cloak, Moody now withdrew a flask of what looked like mud. There was no need for him to say another word. Harry understood the rest of the plan immediately.
No! He said loudly, his voice ringing through the kitchen. No way!
I told them you'd take it like this,
said Hermione with a hint of complacency. If you think I'm going to let 6 people risk their lives...
Because it's the first time for all of us,
said Ron.
This is different. Pretending to be me...
Well, none of us really fancy it, Harry, said Fred earnestly. Imagine if something went wrong and we were stuck as specky, scrawny gits forever.
Harry did not smile.
You can't do it if I don't cooperate. You need me to give you some hair.
Well, that's that plan scuppered, said George.
Obviously, there's no chance at all of us getting a bit of your hair unless you cooperate. Yeah, 13 of us against one bloke who's not allowed to use magic. We've got no chance, said Fred.
Funny, said Harry.
Really amusing.
If it has to come to force, then it will, growled Moody,
his magical eye now quivering a little in its socket as he glared at Harry.
Everyone here's overage, Potter, and they're all prepared to take the risk.
Mundungus shrugged and grimaced. The magical eye swerved sideways to glare at him out of the side of Moody's head.
Let's have no more arguments. Time's wearing on. I want a few of your hairs, boy, now.
But this is mad. There's no need.
No need, snarled Moody.
With you-know-who out there and half the ministry on his side.
Potter, if we're lucky, he'll have swallowed the fake bait and he'll be planning to ambush you on the 30th. But he'd be mad not to have a Death Eater or two keeping an eye out. It's what I'd do. They might not be able to get at you or this house while your mother's charm holds, but it's about to break, and they know the rough position of the place. Our only chance is to use decoys. Even you-know-who can't split himself into seven.
Harry caught Hermione's eye and looked away at once.
So, Potter, some of your hair, if you please.
Harry glanced at Ron, who grimaced at him in a just-do-it sort of way.
Now!
Barked Moody. With all of their eyes upon him, Harry reached up to the top of his head, grabbed a hank of hair, and pulled.
Good, said Moody, limping forward as he pulled the stopper out of the flask of potion. Straight in here, if you please.
Harry dropped the hair into the mud-like liquid. The moment it made contact with its surface, the potion began to froth and smoke. Then, all at once, it turned a clear, bright gold.
"Oh, you look much tastier than Crab and Goyle, Harry," said Hermione, before catching sight of Ron's raised eyebrows, blushing slightly and saying, "Oh, you know what I mean. Goyle's potion looked like bogies."
"Right, then. Fake Potter's line up over here, please," said Moody.
Ron, Hermione, Fred, George, and Fleur lined up in front of Aunt Petunia's gleaming sink.
"We're one short," said Lupin.
"Here!"
said Hagrid gruffly, and he lifted Mundungus by the scruff of the neck and dropped him down beside Fleur, who wrinkled her nose pointedly and moved along to stand between Fred and George instead.
"I've told you, I'd sooner be a protector," said Mundungus.
"Shut it!"
growled Moody.
"As I've already told you, you spineless worm. Any Death Eaters we run into will be aiming to capture Potter, not kill him. Dumbledore always said you know who would want to finish Potter in person. It'll be the Protectors who have got the most to worry about. The Death Eaters will want to kill them."
Mundungus did not look particularly reassured, but Moody was already pulling half a dozen egg-cup-sized glasses from inside his cloak, which he handed out before pouring a little polyjuice potion into each one.
"All together, then."
Ron, Hermione, Fred, George, Fleur, and Mundungus drank. All of them gasped and grimaced as the potion hit their throats. At once, their features began to bubble and distort like hot wax. Hermione and Mundungus were shooting upward. Ron, Fred, and George were shrinking. Their hair was darkening, Hermione's and Fleur's appearing to shoot backward into their skulls. Moody, quite unconcerned, was now loosening the ties of the large sacks he had brought with him. When he straightened up again, there were six Harry Potters gasping and panting in front of him. Fred and George turned to each other and said together,
"Wow! We're identical!
I don't know, though. I think I'm still better looking," said Fred, examining his reflection in the kettle.
"Bah!"
said Fleur, checking herself in the microwave door.
"Bill, don't look at me. I'm hideous."
"Those whose clothes are a bit roomy have got smaller here," said Moody, indicating the first sack. "And vice versa. Don't forget the glasses. There's six pairs in the side pocket, and when you're dressed, there's luggage in the other sack."
The real Harry thought that this might just be the most bizarre thing he had ever seen, and he had seen some extremely odd things. He watched as his six doppelgangers rummaged in the sacks, pulling out sets of clothes, putting on glasses, stuffing their own things away. He felt like asking them to show a little more respect for his privacy as they all began stripping off with impunity, clearly much more at ease with displaying his body than they would have been with their own.
"I knew Ginny was lying about that tattoo," said Ron, looking down at his bare chest. "Harry, your eyesight really is awful," said Hermione as she put on glasses.
Once dressed, the fake Harrys took rucksacks and owl cages, each containing a stuffed snowy owl, from the second sack.
"Good,"
said Moody, as at last seven dressed, bespectacled and luggage-laden Harrys faced him. "The pairs will be as follows. Mundungus will be travelling with me by broom."
"Why am I with you?"
grunted the Harry nearest the back door.
"Because you're the one that needs watching," growled Moody.
And sure enough, his magical eye did not waver from Mundungus as he continued, "Arthur and Fred."
"I'm George," said the twin at whom Moody was pointing. "Can't you even tell us apart when we're Harry?"
"Sorry, George."
"I'm only yanking your wand. I'm Fred, really."
"Enough messing around," snarled Moody. "The other one, George, or Fred, or whoever you are, you're with Remus. Miss Delacour?"
"I'm taking Fleur on a Thestral," said Bill. "She's not that fond of brooms."
Fleur walked over to stand beside him, giving him a soppy, slavish look that Harry hoped with all his heart would never appear on his face again.
"Miss Granger with Kingsley, again by Thestral."
Hermione looked reassured as she answered Kingsley's smile. Harry knew that Hermione, too, lacked confidence on a broomstick.
"Which leaves you and me, Ron,"
said Tonks brightly, knocking over a mug tree as she waved at him. Ron did not look quite as pleased as Hermione.
"And you're with me, Harry. That all right?"
said Hagrid, looking a little anxious.
"We'll be on the bike. Brooms and thestrals can't take me weight, see? Not a lot of room on the seat with me on it, though. So you'll be in the sidecar."
"That's great," said Harry, not altogether truthfully.
"We think the Death Eaters will expect you to be on a broom," said Moody, who seemed to guess how Harry was feeling. "Snape's had plenty of time to tell them everything about you he's never mentioned before. So if we do run into any Death Eaters, we're betting they'll choose one of the Potters who look at home on a broomstick." "All right, then," he went on, tying up the sack with the fake Potter's clothes in it and leading the way back to the door. "I make it 3 minutes until we're supposed to leave. No point locking the back door. It won't keep the Death Eaters out when they come looking. Come on."
Harry hurried into the hall to fetch his rucksack, firebolt, and Hedwig's cage before joining the others in the dark back garden. On every side, broomsticks were leaping into hands. Hermione had already been helped up onto a great black thestral by Kingsley, Fleur onto the other by Bill. Hagrid was standing ready beside the motorbike, goggles on. "Is this it? Is this Sirius's bike?"
"The very same," said Hagrid, beaming down at Harry. "And the last time you was on it, Harry, I could fit you in one hand."
Harry could not help but feel a little humiliated as he got into the sidecar. It placed him several feet below everybody else. Ron smirked at the sight of him sitting there like a child in a bumper car. Harry stuffed his rucksack and broomstick down by his feet and rammed Hedwig's cage between his knees. It was extremely uncomfortable.
"Arthur's done a bit of tinkering,"
said Hagrid, quite oblivious to Harry's discomfort. He settled himself astride the motorcycle, which creaked slightly and sank inches into the ground.
"It's got a few tricks up its handlebars now. That one was my idea."
He pointed a thick finger at a purple button near the speedometer.
"Please be careful, Hagrid," said Mr. Weasley, who was standing beside them holding his broomstick. "I'm still not sure that was advisable, and it's certainly only to be used in emergencies."
"All right, then," said Moody.
"Everyone ready, please. I want us all to leave at exactly the same time, or the whole point of the diversion's lost."
Everybody mounted their brooms.
"Hold tight now, Ron,"
said Tonks.
And Harry saw Ron throw a furtive, guilty look at Lupin before placing his hands on either side of her waist.
Hagrid kicked the motorbike into life. It roared like a dragon, and the sidecar began to vibrate.
"Good luck, everyone!" shouted Moody. "See you all in about an hour at the Burrow. On the count of three, 1, 2, 3!
There was a great roar from the motorbike, and Harry felt the sidecar give a nasty lurch. He was rising through the air, fast, his eyes watering slightly, hair whipped back off his face. Around him, brooms were soaring upward, too. The long black tail of a thestral flicked past. His legs, jammed into the sidecar by Hedwig's cage and his rucksack, were already sore and starting to go numb. So great was his discomfort that he almost forgot to take a last glimpse of No. 4 Privet Drive. By the time he looked over the edge of the sidecar, he could no longer tell which one it was. Higher and higher they climbed into the sky. And then, out of nowhere, out of nothing, they were surrounded. At least 30 hooded figures, suspended in midair, formed a vast circle in the midst of which the Order members had risen, oblivious. Screams, a blaze of green light on every side. Hagrid gave a yell, and the motorbike rolled over. Harry lost any sense of where they were. Streetlights above him, yells around him. He was clinging to the sidecar for dear life. Hedwig's cage, the firebolt, and his rucksack slipped from beneath his knees.
"No! Hedwig!"
The broomstick spun to earth, but he just managed to seize the strap of his rucksack and the top of the cage as the motorbike swung the right way up again. A second's relief, and then another burst of green light. The owl screeched and fell to the floor of the cage.
"No! No!"
The motorbike zoomed forward. Harry glimpsed hooded Death Eaters scattering as Hagrid blasted through their circle.
"Hedwig! Hedwig!"
But the owl lay motionless and pathetic as a toy on the floor of her cage. He could not take it in, and his terror for the others was paramount. He glanced over his shoulder and saw a mass of people moving, flares of green light, 2 pairs of people on brooms soaring off into the distance, but he could not tell who they were.
"Hagrid, we've got to go back! We've got to go back!"
he yelled over the thunderous roar of the engine, pulling out his wand, ramming Hedwig's cage onto the floor, refusing to believe that she was dead.
"Hagrid, turn around!"
"My job's to get you there safe, Harry!"
bellowed Hagrid, and he opened the throttle.
"Stop! Stop!"
Harry shouted, but as he looked back again, 2 jets of green light flew past his left ear. 4 Death Eaters had broken away from the circle and were pursuing them, aiming for Hagrid's broad back. Hagrid swerved, but the Death Eaters were keeping up with the bike. More curses shot after them, and Harry had to sink low into the sidecar to avoid them. Wriggling around, he cried, "Stupefy!" And a red bolt of light shot from his own wand, cleaving a gap between the 4 pursuing Death Eaters as they scattered to avoid it.
"Hold on, Harry! This'll do for 'em!"
roared Hagrid, and Harry looked up just in time to see Hagrid slamming a thick finger into a green button near the fuel gauge. A wall, a solid brick wall, erupted out of the exhaust pipe. Craning his neck, Harry saw it expand into being in midair. 3 of the Death Eaters swerved and avoided it, but the 4th was not so lucky. He vanished from view and then dropped like a boulder from behind it, his broomstick broken into pieces. One of his fellows slowed up to save him, but they and the airborne wall were swallowed by darkness as Hagrid leaned low over the handlebars and sped up. More killing curses flew past Harry's head from the 2 remaining Death Eaters' wands. They were aiming for Hagrid. Harry responded with further stunning spells. Red and green collided in midair in a shower of multicolored sparks, and Harry thought wildly of fireworks and the muggles below who would have no idea what was happening.
"Here we go again, Harry! Hold on!"
yelled Hagrid, and he jabbed at a 2nd button. This time, a great net burst from the bike's exhaust, but the Death Eaters were ready for it. Not only did they swerve to avoid it, but the companion who had slowed to save their unconscious friend had caught up. He bloomed suddenly out of the darkness, and now 3 of them were pursuing the motorbike, all shooting curses after it.
This'll do it, Harry. Hold on tight,
yelled Hagrid, and Harry saw him slam his whole hand onto the purple button beside the speedometer. With an unmistakable bellowing roar, dragonfire burst from the exhaust, white hot and blue, and the motorbike shot forward like a bullet with a sound of wrenching metal. Harry saw the Death Eaters swerve out of sight to avoid the deadly trail of flame, and at the same time felt the sidecar sway ominously. Its metal connections to the bike had splintered with the force of acceleration.
"It's all right, Harry!"
bellowed Hagrid, now thrown flat onto his back by the surge of speed. Nobody was steering now, and the sidecar was starting to twist violently in the bike's slipstream.
"I'm on it, Harry! Don't worry!"
Hagrid yelled, and from inside his jacket pocket, he pulled his flowery pink umbrella.
"Hagrid! No! Let me!"
"Reparo!"
There was a deafening bang, and the sidecar broke away from the bike completely. Harry sped forward, propelled by the impetus of the bike's flight. Then the sidecar began to lose height. In desperation, Harry pointed his wand at the sidecar and shouted,
"Wingardium Leviosa!"
The sidecar rose like a cork, unsteerable, but at least still airborne. He had but a split second's relief, however, as more curses streaked past him. The three Death Eaters were closing in.
"I'm coming, Harry!"
Hagrid yelled out of the darkness, but Harry could feel the sidecar beginning to sink again. Crouching as low as he could, he pointed at the middle of the oncoming figures and yelled,
"Impedimenta!"
The jinx hit the middle Death Eater in the chest. For a moment, the man was absurdly spread-eagled in midair, as though he had hit an invisible barrier. One of his fellows almost collided with him. Then the sidecar began to fall in earnest, and the remaining Death Eater shot a curse so close to Harry that he had to duck below the rim of the car, knocking out a tooth on the edge of his seat.
"I'm coming, Harry! I'm coming!"
A huge hand seized the back of Harry's robes and hoisted him out of the plummeting sidecar. Harry pulled his rucksack with him as he dragged himself onto the motorbike seat and found himself back to back with Hagrid. As they soared upward away from the two remaining Death Eaters, Harry spat blood out of his mouth, pointed his wand at the falling sidecar, and yelled,
"Confringo!"
He knew a dreadful, gut-wrenching pang for Hedwig as it exploded. The Death Eater nearest it was blasted off his broom and fell from sight. His companion fell back and vanished.
"Harry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry," moaned Hagrid. "I shouldn't have tried to repair it myself. You've got no room."
"It's not a problem. Just keep flying,"
Harry shouted back as two more Death Eaters emerged out of the darkness, drawing closer. As the curses came shooting across the intervening space again, Hagrid swerved and zigzagged. Harry knew that Hagrid did not dare use the dragonfire button again, with Harry seated so insecurely. Harry sent stunning spell after stunning spell back at their pursuers, barely holding them off. He shot another blocking jinx at them. The closest Death Eater swerved to avoid it, and his hood slipped, and by the red light of his next stunning spell, Harry saw the strangely blank face of Stanley Shunpike.
"Stan?" "Expelliarmus!" Harry yelled.
"That's him! It's him! It's the real one!"
The hooded Death Eater's shout reached Harry even above the thunder of the motorbike's engine. Next moment, both pursuers had fallen back and disappeared from view.
"Harry, what's happened?"
bellowed Hagrid.
"Where have they gone?"
"I don't know."
But Harry was afraid. The hooded Death Eater had shouted, "It's the real one." How had he known? He gazed around at the apparently empty darkness and felt its menace.
Where were they?
He clambered around on the seat to face forward and seized hold of the back of Hagrid's jacket.
"Hagrid, do the dragonfire thing again. Let's get out of here."
"Hold on tight then, Harry."
There was a deafening, screeching roar again, and the white-blue fire shot from the exhaust. Harry felt himself slipping backward off what little of the seat he had. Hagrid flung backward upon him, barely maintaining his grip on the handlebars.
"I think we've lost them, Harry. I think we've done it,"
yelled Hagrid. But Harry was not convinced. Fear lapped at him as he looked left and right for pursuers he was sure would come. Why had they fallen back? One of them had still had a wand. It's him. It's the real one. They had said it right after he had tried to disarm Stan.
We're nearly there, Harry. We've nearly made it, shouted Hagrid.
Harry felt the bike drop a little, though the lights down on the ground still seemed remote as stars. Then the scar on his forehead burned like fire as a Death Eater appeared on either side of the bike. Two killing curses missed Harry by millimeters, cast from behind. And then Harry saw him. Voldemort was flying like smoke on the wind, without broomstick or thestral to hold him, his snake-like face gleaming out of the blackness, his white fingers raising his wand again. Hagrid let out a bellow of fear and steered the motorbike into a vertical dive. Clinging on for dear life, Harry sent stunning spells flying at random into the whirling night. He saw a body fly past him, and he knew he had hit one of them. But then he heard a bang and saw sparks from the engine. The motorbike spiraled through the air, completely out of control. Green jets of light shot past them again. Harry had no idea which way was up, which down. His scar was still burning. He expected to die at any second. A hooded figure on a broomstick was feet from him. He saw it raise its arm.
No!
With a shout of fury, Hagrid launched himself off the bike at the Death Eater. To his horror, Harry saw both Hagrid and the Death Eater falling out of sight, their combined weight too much for the broomstick. Barely gripping the plummeting bike with his knees, Harry heard Voldemort scream,
"Mine!"
It was over. He could not see or hear where Voldemort was. He glimpsed another Death Eater swooping out of the way and heard,
"Avada!"
As the pain from Harry's scar forced his eyes shut, his wand acted of its own accord. He felt it drag his hand around like some great magnet, saw a spurt of golden fire through his half-closed eyelids, heard a crack and a scream of fury. The remaining Death Eater yelled. Voldemort screamed,
"No!"
Somehow, Harry found his nose an inch from the dragonfire button. He punched it with his wand-free hand, and the bike shot more flames into the air, hurtling straight toward the ground.
"Hagrid!"
Harry called, holding onto the bike for dear life.
"Hagrid! Accio, Hagrid!"
The motorbike sped up, sucked toward the earth. Face level with the handlebars, Harry could see nothing but distant lights growing nearer and nearer. He was going to crash, and there was nothing he could do about it. Behind him came another scream.
"Your wand, Selwyn! Give me your wand!"
He felt Voldemort before he saw him. Looking sideways, he stared into the red eyes and was sure they would be the last thing he ever saw. Voldemort preparing to curse him once more. And then Voldemort vanished. Harry looked down and saw Hagrid spread-eagled on the ground below him. He pulled hard at the handlebars to avoid hitting him, groped for the brake, but with an ear-splitting, ground-trembling crash, he smashed into a muddy pond. Chapter 5. Fallen Warrior.
"Hagrid?"
Harry struggled to raise himself out of the debris of metal and leather that surrounded him. His hands sank into inches of muddy water as he tried to stand. He could not understand where Voldemort had gone and expected him to swoop out of the darkness at any moment. Something hot and wet was trickling down his chin and from his forehead. He crawled out of the pond and stumbled toward the great dark mass on the ground that was Hagrid.
"Hagrid? Hagrid? Talk to me."
But the dark mass did not stir.
"Who's there? Is it Potter? Are you Harry Potter?"
Harry did not recognize the man's voice. Then a woman shouted,
"They've crashed! Ted! Crashed in the garden!"
Harry's head was swimming.
"Hagrid,"
he repeated stupidly, and his knees buckled. The next thing he knew, he was lying on his back on what felt like cushions, with a burning sensation in his ribs and right arm. His missing tooth had been regrown. The scar on his forehead was still throbbing.
"Hagrid?"
He opened his eyes and saw that he was lying on a sofa in an unfamiliar lamplit sitting room. His rucksack lay on the floor a short distance away, wet and muddy. A fair-haired, big-bellied man was watching Harry anxiously.
Hagrid's fine, son, said the man. The wife's seeing to him now. How are you feeling? Anything else broken? I've fixed your ribs, your tooth, and your arm. I'm Ted, by the way. Ted Tonks, Dora's father.
Harry sat up too quickly. Lights popped in front of his eyes, and he felt sick and giddy.
Voldemort, easy now, said Ted Tonks, placing a hand on Harry's shoulder and pushing him back against the cushions. That was a nasty crash you just had. What happened, anyway? Something go wrong with the bike? Arthur Weasley overstretch himself again? Him and his muggle contraptions?
No, said Harry, as his scar pulsed like an open wound. Death Eaters.
Loads of them.
We were chased.
Death Eaters? Said Ted sharply. What do you mean, Death Eaters? I thought they didn't know you were being moved tonight. I thought...
They knew, said Harry. Ted Tonks looked up at the ceiling as though he could see through it to the sky above.
Well, we know our protective charms hold then, don't we? They shouldn't be able to get within 100 yards of the place in any direction.
Now Harry understood why Voldemort had vanished. It had been at the point when the motorbike crossed the barrier of the Order's charms. He only hoped they would continue to work. He imagined Voldemort 100 yards above them as they spoke, looking for a way to penetrate what Harry visualized as a great transparent bubble. He swung his legs off the sofa. He needed to see Hagrid with his own eyes before he would believe that he was alive. He had barely stood up, however, when a door opened, and Hagrid squeezed through it, his face covered in mud and blood, limping a little, but miraculously alive.
Harry!
Knocking over 2 delicate tables and an aspidistra, he covered the floor between them in 2 strides and pulled Harry into a hug that nearly cracked his newly repaired ribs.
Blimey, Harry, how did you get out of that? I thought we were both goners.
Yeah, me too. I can't believe... Harry broke off. He had just noticed the woman who had entered the room behind Hagrid.
You!
He shouted, and he thrust his hand into his pocket, but it was empty.
Your wand's here, son, said Ted, tapping it on Harry's arm. It fell right beside you. I picked it up.
And that's my wife you're shouting at.
Oh, I'm sorry.
As she moved forward into the room, Mrs. Tonks's resemblance to her sister Bellatrix became much less pronounced. Her hair was a light, soft brown, and her eyes were wider and kinder. Nevertheless, she looked a little haughty after Harry's exclamation.
"What happened to our daughter?" she asked. "Hagrid said you were ambushed. Where is Nymphadora?"
"I don't know," said Harry. "We don't know what happened to anyone else." She and Ted exchanged looks. A mixture of fear and guilt gripped Harry at the sight of their expressions. If any of the others had died... It was his fault, all his fault. He had consented to the plan, given them his hair.
"The portkey,"
he said, remembering all of a sudden.
"We've got to get back to the burrow and find out. Then we'll be able to send you word, or Tonks will, once she's..."
"Dora will be okay, Dromida," said Ted. "She knows her stuff. She's been in plenty of tight spots with the Aurors. The portkey's through here," he added to Harry. "It's supposed to leave in 3 minutes, if you want to take it."
"Yeah, we do," said Harry.
He seized his rucksack, swung it onto his shoulders. He looked at Mrs. Tonks, wanting to apologize for the state of fear in which he left her, and for which he felt so terribly responsible. But no words occurred to him that did not seem hollow and insincere.
"I'll tell Tonks, Dora, to send word when she... Thanks for patching us up. Thanks for everything.
He was glad to leave the room and follow Ted Tonks along a short hallway and into a bedroom. Hagrid came after them, bending low to avoid hitting his head on the door lintel.
"There you go, son. That's the portkey."
Mr. Tonks was pointing to a small silver-backed hairbrush lying on the dressing table.
"Thanks,"
said Harry, reaching out to place a finger on it, ready to leave.
"Wait a moment," said Hagrid, looking around. "Harry, where's Hedwig?"
She got hit, said Harry.
The realization crashed over him. He felt ashamed of himself as the tears stung his eyes. The owl had been his companion, his one great link with the magical world whenever he had been forced to return to the Dursleys. Hagrid reached out a great hand and patted him painfully on the shoulder.
"Never mind," he said gruffly. "Never mind. She had a great old life."
"Hagrid," said Ted Tonks warningly as the hairbrush glowed bright blue, and Hagrid only just got his forefinger to it in time. With a jerk behind the navel as though an invisible hook and line had dragged him forward, Harry was pulled into nothingness, spinning uncontrollably, his finger glued to the portkey as he and Hagrid hurtled away from Mr. Tonks. Seconds later, Harry's feet slammed onto hard ground, and he fell onto his hands and knees in the yard of the burrow. He heard screams. Throwing aside the no longer glowing hairbrush, Harry stood up, swaying slightly, and saw Mrs. Weasley and Ginny running down the steps by the back door as Hagrid, who had also collapsed on landing, clambered laboriously to his feet.
"Harry, you are the real Harry? What happened? Where are the others?" cried Mrs. Weasley.
"What do you mean? Isn't anyone else back?"
Harry panted. The answer was clearly etched in Mrs. Weasley's pale face.
"The Death Eaters were waiting for us," Harry told her. "We were surrounded the moment we took off. They knew it was tonight. I don't know what happened to anyone else. Four of them chased us. It was all we could do to get away. And then Voldemort caught up with us."
He could hear the self-justifying note in his voice, the plea for her to understand why he did not know what had happened to her sons. But,
"Thank goodness you're all right," she said, pulling him into a hug he did not feel he deserved.
"Haven't got any brandy, have you, Molly?"
asked Hagrid, a little shakily.
"For medicinal purposes."
She could have summoned it by magic, but as she hurried back toward the Crooked House, Harry knew that she wanted to hide her face. He turned to Ginny, and she answered his unspoken plea for information at once.
"Ron and Tonks should have been back first, but they missed their portkey. It came back without them," she said, pointing at a rusty oil can lying on the ground nearby.
"And that one," she pointed at an ancient sneaker, "should have been Dad and Fed's. They were supposed to be second. You and Hagrid were third, and..." She checked her watch.
"If they made it, George and Lupin ought to be back in about a minute."
Mrs. Weasley reappeared, carrying a bottle of brandy, which she handed to Hagrid. He uncorked it and drank it straight down in one.
"Mom!"
shouted Ginny, pointing to a spot several feet away. A blue light had appeared in the darkness. It grew larger and brighter, and Lupin and George appeared, spinning and then falling. Harry knew immediately that there was something wrong. Lupin was supporting George, who was unconscious and whose face was covered in blood. Harry ran forward and seized George's legs. Together, he and Lupin carried George into the house and through the kitchen to the sitting room, where they laid him on the sofa. As the lamplight fell across George's head, Ginny gasped and Harry's stomach lurched. One of George's ears was missing. The side of his head and neck were drenched in wet, shockingly scarlet blood. No sooner had Mrs. Weasley bent over her son than Lupin grabbed Harry by the upper arm and dragged him, none too gently, back into the kitchen, where Hagrid was still attempting to ease his bulk through the back door.
"Oi!"
said Hagrid indignantly.
"Let go of him! Let go of Harry!"
Lupin ignored him.
"What creature sat in the corner the first time that Harry Potter visited my office at Hogwarts?" he said, giving Harry a small shake. "Answer me."
A Grindylow in a tank, wasn't it?" Lupin released Harry and fell back against a kitchen cupboard.
"What was that about?"
roared Hagrid.
"I'm sorry, Harry, but I had to check," said Lupin tersely. "We've been betrayed. Voldemort knew that you were being moved tonight, and the only people who could have told him were directly involved in the plan. You might have been an imposter."
"So why aren't you checking me?"
panted Hagrid, still struggling to fit through the door.
"You're half-giant," said Lupin, looking up at Hagrid. "The Polyjuice potion is designed for human use only. None of the Order would have told Voldemort we were moving tonight," said Harry.
The idea was dreadful to him. He could not believe it of any of them.
Voldemort only caught up with me toward the end. He didn't know which one I was in the beginning. If he'd been in on the plan, he'd have known from the start I was the one with Hagrid.
Voldemort caught up with you? Said Lupin sharply.